Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. We are excited to have a panel discussion again, like we always do, about fun and interesting issues in Mormonism, things that were in the news recently, or simply broader issues that have come up that we felt like it would be fun to turn some of our brightest minds and good, articulate friends loose on. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to take the broader issue of Mormons and intellectual gifts, the suspicion of intellectual gifts, how to negotiate the world of everyday Mormonism if you are a person with one of these intellectual gifts. And also, we're combining that with just the jumping off point that sort of got us thinking about this again, which is the publishing a few weeks ago in the Deseret News, which is actually a republishing of a list that Leonard J. Arrington compiled years ago. He surveyed some of his friends or whatnot, and we'll learn more about that. But he listed the 10 most eminent intellectuals in Mormon history back in 1969. There was a follow-up survey that happened 20 or 25 years later, and then it was just republished in the Deseret News, and it's generated some fun online buzz, as everyone says, who's on there that shouldn't be on there, who... why aren't there any women in this list, and all sorts of things. So we're going to just use that as our jumping off point, and we'll start there, and then we will go into the broader discussion. So we're excited to have you all listening and appreciate that. And I know you will appreciate the fact that Joanna Brooks is back again this week. Thanks for joining us, Joanna.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Dan, and and here on Mormon Matters with all the listeners. Always fun.
Good. And just in case we have first listeners here, you got to give us your street cred.
I write a column 2 to 3 times a week, usually on Mormonism, for a great online religion magazine called ReligionDispatches.org. I also have the Ask Mormon Girl column at AskMormonGirl.com and Feminist Mormon Housewives. So happy to be here.
Yep, and you're a teacher of lit and things at San Diego State University. And do you want to tell people where you are right now and what you're doing?
Right. Speaking of the intellectual life, right now I am a fellow in residence at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is a 90-year-old anthropological think tank.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And so they're giving you a chance to write and think as well as...
to write stuff that does not pertain to Mormonism.
I guess everybody has to slum it every once in a while.
You know,
right?
gotta get my bread and butter somehow.
Well, cool. Well, welcome again, and
we're
grateful to have you. Christine Haglin is joining us again. We're very excited. How is this, third or fourth time, Christine?
I don't know.
for sure, it's at least your third.
I know track.
That much.
You're
just having so much fun.
I can't remember all the places I've talked.
Anyway, well, we're grateful to have you. Would you give us a quick background for those who've been out of the loop and don't know who you are?
Sure. I'm the editor of Dialogue, and I blog at By Common Consent. And sometimes people accuse me of being an intellectual, although my 12-year-old is convinced and has told me several times today that I'm an idiot. So y'all can decide at the end.
Very cool. Very cool. Anyway, that's too fun. Boyd Peterson is our third guest. For the people who don't know who you are, Boyd, start, and you know I'm going to come hard with a lot more credentials than you lay out here. So tell our listeners who you are.
Well, I teach in the English department at Utah Valley University, and I'm the program coordinator for Mormon Studies, which is a fancy title for the guy who gets to plan the program. We have an annual Mormon Studies conference, and then we have a Eugene England lecture, and so I get to plan those every year. So that's what I do for a living.
And you're one of my good friends. And what is your connection with a famous Mormon scholar who actually is on the list?
So I wrote the biography for Hugh Nibley. He was my father-in-law, and so that's my 15-minute claim to fame.
But it is the award-winning biography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fantastic book. And and Boyd, I just love your approach to these questions. I know that you're, being there at UVU, you're actually interacting a lot with Mormon students and people who are considering this. Am I going to be able to marry my intellect and my faith and find a place within the church? So you're positioned in a great place to contribute a lot to this discussion. We appreciate having you.
Yep.
Thanks.
Gene England said UVU was where it was at.
It was
the place.
So we're still doing it, so carrying on his legacy. He's got big shoes to fill, but we're fine with it.
Well, cool. Thanks, everybody. I'm so excited to have you guys, and I really have been looking forward to this topic. And a little bit ahead of time, for those of you who are listeners, you might guess that we occasionally circulate a little document that sort of gives us some ideas of where we might want to go with our conversation. And I have asked Christine Haglund to take the lead here at the very first part to just sort of introduce us to that original survey with Leonard Arrington, and all the way bringing it up to the Deseret News and their recent release. So, Christine, if you can kind of just give us all the background that you'd love to on that.
Sure. I actually have no idea why the Deseret News would have pulled this out now. We can talk about what that means to reprint this list now. But the original impetus was Arrington wrote an article in Dialogue called The Intellectual Tradition Among the Latter-day Saints. And he is basically just looking at whether there is such a thing as a Mormon intellectual, whether any Mormons really are truly intellectuals, if you can be Mormon and be intellectual, and if so, who they are. He concludes relatively quickly that there are such things as Mormon intellectuals. And I just want to read a little bit of his framing, because it's charming and probably also important. He starts with Webster's New International Dictionary, like all good Mormons do.
Yeah.
Right. An intellectual, according to Webster's New International Dictionary, is a person of superior intelligence, a person devoted to matters of the mind, and especially to the arts and letters, a person given to study, reflection, and speculation, especially concerning large, profound, or abstract issues, a person engaged in activity requiring preeminently the use of the intellect. He, of course it's he, is usually viewed as a person who is capable of commenting upon society and its problems, quote, with greater detachment than those more directly caught up in the practical business of production and power. And so then he asks, there's a special problem involved in seeking to denote intellectuals in a religious group as fully committed as the Latter-day Saints. A real intellectual, it is said, will not subordinate rationalism to other ways of knowing, such as authoritarianism or mysticism. But good Mormons will do so, for that is part of being good Mormons. So-called Mormon intellectuals, it is said, will rationalize that revelation is superior to reason. Should one water down the word intellectual by including the bright and industrious Mormon scholars who have failed the acid test of standing outside their own culture and evaluating it all the way on the basis of the best thinking of men? Such a high standard for the classification real intellectuals would reduce substantially the number of real Mormons who could qualify. So that's how he sort of lays out the problem. And then he, rather than solving it theoretically, he just surveys 50 people who were recommended to him by a few close friends in various fields. And he asked them to name the five preeminent Latter-day Saint intellectuals, is how he phrased it. And he said not to include natural scientists, which is probably why Henry Eyring doesn't make right. that original list. And then he just gave the top 10 results of that. And that list, that top 10 results, is what just got reprinted in the Deseret News, only without any of the sort of really interesting history that Arrington tries to lay out about, you know, how we came to this point and what it means to try to situate a Latter-day Saint intellectual in larger culture, in the intellectual tradition of the West, presumably.
Cool. And before you go on to a little bit the evolution of the story, can you tell our listeners who's on that list, or if you have it in front of you, or I can, I can do it.
Go ahead, Dan. It'll take me a second. So.
Well, B.H. Roberts was number one in the survey, followed by Orson Pratt. Joseph Smith was third, which is interesting and probably deserves a little bit of our time tonight. Sterling McMurrin was fourth. James E. Talmadge was listed fifth. And then you get John A. Widsoe, Lowell Bunyan, Hugh Nibley, yay, Boyd, Parley Pratt, and then Ephraim Erickson, E.E. Erickson. So that was the original 10 that were listed there, and that's what the Deseret Book reprinted. So, Christine, can you take us to were you ready to take us into the Stan Larson follow-up?
Sure.
Okay.
So in 1993, Stan Larson did a brief follow-up, and he tried to reproduce Arrington's methodology to some extent, and he didn't explain in any more detail than Arrington did who could be included or excluded. And he says, admittedly, this statement is ambiguous since it could mean historians who are actively writing on various topics in Mormon history, or individuals who in Mormon history from 1830 to the present stand out as the most intellectually brilliant, or individuals who happen to be Mormon but are geniuses in their chosen field. And so he sort of deliberately left it ambiguous to see what people would come up with. Apparently, not all Mormon intellectuals are good at following directions, because several of them voted for only four people, and a couple of people voted for Jan Shipps, despite instructions to exclude non-Mormons. And the 10 he comes up with are actually the top 10. He lists a total of about 25, but the top 10 are remarkably similar, actually, to Arrington's. B.H. Roberts is first again, Orson Pratt, Sterling McMurrin, Leonard Arrington, Joseph Smith Jr. comes in fifth this time, James Talmadge, Hugh W. Nibley, John A. Widsoe, Lowell L. Bunyan, Parley P. Pratt, Henry Eyring, Eliza R. Snow, I think is number 10.
Well, great. And so we had 1969, 1993, and now that, as far as I know, this has been the only attempt to do something like this that we've ever had. And so now the Deseret News is taking us with back to the 1969 list. But it has started a discussion online a little bit. And Joanna, would you mind, as I've asked you ahead of time, I don't want to look like I'm springing it on you here.
You are so being the professor tonight. You have given us
homework. Sorry about that.
You are anyway, falling upon us in class.
Anyway, would you kind of frame what's been happening online, however you'd like?
Yes. Well, first, you know, let's just start with the Deseret News piece. I mean, here it is. It materializes out of cyberspace. Top 10 LDS intellectuals. Intellectuals is in scare quotes. It's in the Deseret News. And it's basically just without much preface or rationale for existing, a recap of Leonard Arrington's top 10 from 1969, which is, I have to say, sort of terrific, because it wasn't too long ago that, you know, that high-ranking church leaders were referring to intellectuals as dangers to the church. So to see the Des News promote, feature a list of intellectuals feels kind of good, I have to say. And as usual, as anyone who reads the Des News online knows, the comments are really interesting. Great ethnography, sometimes, of our Mormon culture. and a really good view.
Please don't let that be true. I mean, it is, but it's the worst in human nature for the most part.
There's some good people.
Performs the controversy.
Yeah, great. Okay, go ahead.
I'm not going to be all judgy about the readers on the Des News. I'm just going to say it's really good ethnography of our people.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, and the comments that the initial feature got were very interesting if you read through them. You know, a lot of people were chiming in and suggesting people to add to the list. I'm going to share with you just a few of the recommended ads because they point to a more fundamental problem that I think we've already dealt with a little bit with Christine's, you know, reviewing Arrington's definition of what intellectual is. Lots of people pointed out the fact that Henry Eyring was overlooked, which can be accounted for by the fact that Arrington didn't want to deal with natural science. And then you have people who basically started listing any general authority or president of the church they perceive to be especially smart. So Gordon Hinckley, Ezra Taft Benson, Bruce McConkie listed as, well, they should be among the top intellectuals. Then you had people suggest Cleon Skousen. And others said, well, no, not Cleon Skousen. And then still others saying, yeah, reading Nibley or Skousen could get you in trouble with the church. And I always find this really interesting. I mean, already we sense, you know, among the readers of the Des News, there's this continuing sense in LDS culture that intellectual is a tricky, if not dangerous, category. So,
for sure.
You know, so that's where it started with the readers at the Des News and spun off from there into many other discussions at sites across the Bloggernacle. But where I kind of want to focus us for a second is on this question of defining intellectualism within the context of Mormonism. Is an intellectual anyone who is smart in public, right? I mean, here we have everyone who's saying, well, Gordon B. Hinckley, great thinker, you know, to some, great intellectual. But to me, kind of reading this list as a scholar, you know, someone who has devoted many years of professional vocational training and who understands what it means to be intellectual from a very professional modern sense, I come at it a whole different way. And I think that's a sense that's not widely trafficked in Mormon culture, but one that certainly everyone on this panel, you know, who has too many degrees, shares. And it's that, you know, when you presume to become an intellectual, it's not just that you like ideas or that you're smart. It's that you've spent a lot of time acquiring a very specific kind of discipline in the way you go about thinking and relating to the history of ideas. It's that discipline that leads everything, that sense that you have a responsibility to participate in this long conversation across the centuries and to contribute to contemporary problem solving in the realm of ideas in ways that are really, really responsible. I don't know. Does that sound right to you, Boyd, Christine, you know, as like a modern vocational sense of what it means to be an intellectual?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, I think that sounds a little bit more to me like being an academic, and I think there is probably a distinction there that's useful. I tend to think of intellectual as describing a particular temperament, sort of somebody who, you know, lives life from the neck up and tends to think their way through problems rather than emote. And you know, there's a large overlap between that type of temperament and people who do become academics, but I'm not sure it's total, and I think we might want to tease that out a little bit.
Right. No, I agree with you, Christine, because I don't think that someone who leads with the head as a definition of what it means to be intellectual is actually sometimes at odds with the sense that scholars have of responsibility and humility and discipline and vocational, you know, a vocational obligation. And then I think of someone like Lowell Bennion, right, who did not lead with the head in his public self-presentation, but who trained with Max Weber. I mean, he trained with some of the very finest and most central, you know, scholarly, academic, intellectual figures of his time. And that, for me, is more like, if we want to talk about an interesting, you know, way of shifting this idea of an intellectual within Mormon culture from, you know, headstrong and therefore dangerous to someone who combines heart, head, and training. But then I could come at it a whole different angle just to totally pop this conversation open, and then I'll be quiet for a minute. You know, thinking about Mormonism as a terrifically pragmatic tradition in many respects, and in what sense does a list that focuses on intellectuals as, you know, sort of a person who's very interested in a very specific dimension of human experience that's all in the head and with ideas, what does that, does that exclude like vast regions of cultural production that convey a certain kind of genius? And this is an idea we can come back to later, maybe when we talk about LDS Wave's response to the gendering of this list. But, you know, can we even capture what we might call Mormon genius if we just define the list as intellectuals?
Yeah, and that's a problem that Arrington points to, right, when he says, you know, considering profound and abstract questions, that's so not Mormon, you know.
I mean, we have a tradition.
I just realized I'm the only person on this panel without a PhD, so there may be a great deal of self-justification in my desire to say that intellectuals don't have to be academics.
Oh man!
No, no, no. But I only lay out that perspective though because I think the word intellectual is so loaded, and it does get thrown around in our culture, and it's mostly as an accusation or has been, which is why I was delighted to see the Deseret News featured in this positive way. So you know, I'm trying to introduce another definition of intellectual onto the table to convey a sense that, you know, look, those of us who do this work professionally, and I would include you, Christine. You know, discipline is the first mark of an intellectual, a real intellectual, from an academic point of view.
But if you look at the list, I think one thing you'll find is that most of those people serve not so much an intellectual function as an apologetic function. And I think that may be part of the reason that list is laden with a certain type of academic.
Well, then, boy, that would bring up a whole different way. So basically, we're just trying to tease out all the different meanings of intellectuals as this grab-all category, you know. And so the Des News list has a lot of folks who you would characterize as being engaged in apologetics, some of whom are also actually professional scholars, and some of whom are also head-leading intellectuals. But not all of these categories overlap perfectly.
Right, and also it occurs to me on the apologetic angle that you must be thinking primarily of the Pratt brothers and especially the early guys on the list, because when you get into well, you might be the one to be able to tell me whether Nibley considered himself an apologist. I know he was in some ways, but in other ways he was a button pusher.
Yeah.
You know, is trying to advance the discussion in different ways.
Well, he went both directions in terms of the intellectuals. I mean, he published in scholarly peer-reviewed journals, but I think his main focus, especially after about 1960, was really defending the church, which in turn gave him a lot of street cred and enabled him to become a kind of social critic among the culture. So, and I think Lowell Binion served a similar function. Of kind of social critic, and so, so I don't know. I think that, you know, in terms of that safety issue within the church of what's a safe scholar, why the Deseret News would suddenly be publishing a list of scholars, I think part of it is that you know, these scholars served a kind of larger purpose of defending the kingdom.
Interesting. I guess I don't see that very many of them that I would say, oh, apologist, you know, when I look at the list. But that's interesting. And certainly there is that apologetic role, but I don't see it in the terms of, at least maybe the way apologetics is sometimes comes across today, which is like, I'm going to shape the argument. No, even if it's a weaker argument, I'm still going to shape it and make sure to put that forward first. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm not using the term in a negative way. I don't think it's necessarily a negative term. I just think that, you know, one of the things that I think is difficult about this discussion is people, when they go through the temple, especially, they make a commitment to consecrate everything, all of their gifts, to the church. And so how does that leads to a first problem of how does an intellectual consecrate that gift, which isn't always well received.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get into this. Do you guys want to get into it now?
Let's go, because I'm all, yeah, yes. Christine wants to say something.
Yeah, okay, I just want to say, I think it's important, too, to look at the historical moment in which Arrington published his list. I mean, that's sort of the very end of, to borrow Armin Moss's paradigm of assimilation and retrenchment, it's the very end of Mormon assimilation with the broader American culture. And so Arrington is in part pulling out this list of intellectuals to say to Mormons, see, it's okay to be an intellectual. But he's also thinking about an external audience and saying, see, Mormons can too be intellectuals. You know, these are really smart and really accomplished people. And so, you know, he's walking that line. But then if you look at the 1993 list, you see a very different moment in history, and you start seeing, I think, more influence of the conflict in the church over the role of intellectuals. So the first, you know, the first four or five are pretty uncontroversial, except for Sterling McMurrin. But then pretty quickly you get to Bennion, you get to Richard Bushman, you get to Tom Alexander, Fawn Brody, Gene England, Michael Quinn. You're into this historical moment. There's nobody from BYU on that list anymore, and there are hardly any general authorities. Dallin Oaks still makes the list, and J. Reuben Clark. But you're seeing this much stronger divide within the church between sort of liberal intellectuals and conservative or apologist intellectuals who are all now at, you know, farms and BYU and are not included in this dialogue list in 1993. And I think it's impossible for us now to look back at Arrington's list and not have that lens of, you know, having lived through the 90s and seeing this bifurcation. And so it's weird to look at that list from 1969 where you can't quite tell yet who's on which side of the divide.
Christine, how would you look back and characterize, you know, as someone who has a great grasp on, you know, Mormon intellectual history, how would you characterize or narrate what happened between 1970 or, you know, roughly, and 1993 that led to what you're describing as the opening up of a divide between apologists or apologetics and liberal intellectuals? And, you know, that's a divide that by the 90s had some firm institutional underpinnings. So what happened?
I'm sure that if I could articulate that succinctly and well, somebody would give me a PhD for it, and no one has yet. So let me see if I can.
Try the rough draft.
Yeah. I think it is this moment where what happens in broader American society all of a sudden becomes something we don't want to assimilate to, right? All of a sudden... Mm-hmm. You know, what's happened in the 60s is really scary and seems threatening to our core values. And so we're not so interested anymore in proving that we're just like all the other Americans, right? All of a sudden we're sort of pulling back and mm-hmm. drawing boundaries. We're doing this Mossian retrenchment. And yet I think it's inevitable, maybe, or at least probable, that people who are pursuing their living by their wits as intellectuals are going to need to be more involved with the surrounding culture, right? I mean, it's not really an option if you're teaching English at San Diego State to not know feminist theory, right? You can't mm-hmm. shy away from it in the way that good Mormons are wanting to shy away from feminism. So it seems inevitable that intellectuals should be on this dividing line. You know, I think it's fairly simple. That's what happened. They're still trying to make Mormonism fit with sort of liberal, small L mm-hmm. American values and the values of the academy. And, you know, it turns out that, as Arrington had pointed out, they really are in conflict in some instances. And you also have a few really strong personalities in the Quorum of the Twelve who anti-intellectual is not quite subtle enough a description, but it'll work as a shorthand. And, you know, they exert a great deal of influence over church culture. And then the other thing that's going on that starts earlier than the 70s, but really sort of reaches its apex in the 70s is correlation, right? Sort of, so mm-hmm. this insistence that Mormonism comes from the top down. And, you know, you have Elder Packer in 1992 or so saying that, you know, leaders should never face from their congregations towards the leadership, sort of bringing something from the congregation. They should always be facing, you know, with the leadership down towards the people. It's very sort of anti-Vatican II. So there's this insistence that truth and correctness has to do more with authority than with reason necessarily. You know, the mantle is greater than the intellect, right? That's another really important speech that comes out of that time.
Mm-hmm. So I hear you saying sort of like the culture wars happened in the rest of America and we retrenched, right? And then we combined that with increasing kind of retrenchment emphasis on correlation, and you get a divide. And those who come up through secular universities inevitably, you know, experiment with feminism and, you know, and post-structuralist point of views that change the orientation and make them non-assimilable anymore to sort of the heavy correlation framework of Mormon thought, right?
Right.
What if, and I'm just going to toss out an idea here, what if retrenchment paradoxically provided still, even in these retrenching years, there was still in Mormon culture a safe harbor for some of the more speculative elements of our tradition? That, you know, even in the shadow of heavy administrative mandates and a lot of emphasis on correlation and on obedience as the keynotes of teachings, especially into the early 90s, there's this longer Mormon tradition fueled by passages in the Doctrine and Covenants and, you know, thought by Orson Pratt and others that does aspire to the mystical and the beyond rational and the magical, and that we see that then coming through in the works of scholars like Mike Quinn and even Richard Bushman to some extent. I'm just thinking of the work of a scholar of culture named Raymond Williams, who talked about dominant, residual, and emergent modes of thought. And his point was that sometimes there are elements of a culture's past that then emerge and become elements of its future. Because I don't know if I see Mike Quinn doing what Mike Quinn does just because he went to grad school and studied feminism. You know what I mean? I see him as maybe having protected and still buying on to, you know, still trying to be in that realm of speculative Mormon thought that's been a distinctive part of our culture over the centuries, but that was so hammered down by the very pragmatic aspects of retrenchment.
Wow.
What do you think? Does that sound like it's full of hooey? Because it could be.
No, it doesn't. I think that's it's a little bit of a trap for Mormon liberals, right? To think that they are preserving the true strain of, you know, and I
didn't say true.
Right. It's one that wasn't surfacing, now surfaces.
There's this sort of romanticized version of, you know, of Joseph Smith's Mormonism that intellectuals are preserving, whereas Brigham Young's the practical one. You know, and I just,
sure.
Your articulation was far more subtle than that, but I that's a trap that I think is too easy to fall into as well.
Joanna, I certainly hadn't thought of that, and I'll tell you, part of me was jumping up and down saying yay, because some of those speculative ideas are the things that really keep me around and kind of excite my brain in this day and age where sometimes it does feel so top down that these are the ideas breaking through.
I
want to celebrate that.
And I think if we want to hone in on, you know, good ways, you know, ways to define intellectual activity within Mormonism that don't necessarily have to do with this cartoonish figure that's drawn of the intellectual, someone headstrong who wants to get into a fight in gospel doctrine about something no one cares about. We can't reach
not
that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's a personal thing for me, this cultural allergy to intellectualism, because honey, I was just born this way, you know, it's like Lady Gaga says, you know, and I've never, you know, I don't like to argue at church. It's not what I like to do.
It's what I do for a living. I don't think of myself as a headstrong person. I'm an extremely heart-driven person. And yet I've had this term intellectual lobbed to me by people very close to me in the most hurtful way, in the way that I would never say to the people I go to church with every Sunday, "You capitalist pigs!" You know, which sends me wanting to kind of go back to Boyd's question, then I'll be quiet for a while. I mean, Boyd, I hear what you're saying, Boyd, about this issue of, you know, when people go to the temple and even non-temple attending Mormons, you know, there is a sense that intellectual gifts are somehow less acceptable on the altar. It's kind of like you're Cain and you brought vegetables. No good, you know. But folks who are really entrepreneurial, really business savvy, nowhere in the scriptures does it say that those gifts are particularly acceptable to God, but they have attained such a place in contemporary Mormon culture. And we rarely hear people interrogate whether multimillionaire captains of industry or even just, you know, really successful multi-level marketers should be worried about their gifts on the altar.
Yeah, and I just, what's that eye of the needle thing? Yeah.
Yeah, you got to script a lot of scripture to ignore that.
Yep.
So I'm interested in sort of like as a group kind of reflecting critically on, because, you know, on the caution we've been taught to feel about intellectual gifts. What are the dangers really spiritually of these gifts, Boyd, that you were thinking of that would make them kind of unacceptable as a consecrated gift?
Well, I remember back in the 80s, there was a book that came out from Deseret Book called it was just called Excellence. This was in the era when they were putting out books on joy and mothers and fathers.
Oh, my great aunt Elizabeth had an essay in that book.
Yeah, it was a great little book in some parts, anyway. And Gene England had an essay in there which really stood out. And his title was "The Trouble with Excellence." And in that essay, he talks a little bit about this notion that a lot of our gifts are paradoxically both good and bad, and
absolutely,
we need to strive for excellence, and yet at the same time we need to retain some humility. And I think, you know, one thing that the intellectual in the church has a problem with is that, you know, our gifts really aren't always appreciated.
Right.
But I think we also have to realize that one of the problems with the academy, we like to think of us as being very humble people, but in reality, we're not. I think one of the biggest faults of most intellectuals is that we're really very profoundly troubled people by mainly pride. We have problems with that.
Do you think intellectuals as a class are any more troubled by pride than entrepreneurials as a class?
Well, let's think about it. I mean, I actually do, in the sense that, you know, I've got a PhD, and so I'm not making $150,000 a year or more, and so, you know, I have to be proud of my little accomplishment because it's so small. Whereas somebody who's got a big house on the hill, they don't have to say a whole lot about that.
Interesting. Now, if I remember that same essay, Boyd, Gene talks about the two gifts, though, that are the most dangerous and worrisome in terms of this pride question, and it was money,
yeah,
and intellectual gift. These are the things that society sort of lifts up generally as the things, and those who have those things have the biggest challenges.
No, I think that's true, and Hugh Nibley always said that too. That was his big thing. Is money is the big problem. He called it Satan's golden question. So I'm not suggesting that's the only thing. But I do think that we often underestimate the problem with intellectual pride.
Oh well, see, I'm a department chair at a university, and I will tell you, I am aware of academic character and characters. You know, but at the same time, you know, I'm just going to play intellectual's advocate here just for a second, because I'm sort of interested in just shifting the conversation just a little bit, and, you know, LDS intellectuals not feeling like we are especially bad. You know, if I mouth off and I get less than humble and I publish a mouthy article in a journal, you know, 100 people
are just... The editor will save you.
The editor might save me. And then 100 people are going to read it.
If I'm a captain of industry and I'm employing thousands upon thousands of people, including maybe some of my fellow Mormons at poverty wages, how many lives does that damage? Just for perspective's sake. I'm just interrogating where our sense comes from that the intellectual gifts, as potent as they are, and yes, as many problems as intellectuals do have of being rigid and proud, are especially dangerous to the kingdom.
Well, I think one of the problems is that when we use those intellectual gifts when we study religion, we often get into areas where things are a little more muddy.
Now that's interesting.
And I think that's one of the big problems is that we want the basic catechistic answer in Sunday school. We don't want to get into the deeper discussions. And I think that's where a lot of this trouble comes from, is that our gifts are viewed with suspicion, and they have been from the beginning. I mean, I don't think that there's anything necessarily new in the idea that intellectual gifts have been perceived with a certain amount of skepticism, because, skepticism itself calls into question all of those bigger questions.
And yet across the centuries, if you take the really long historical view, churches and religious traditions have been, you know, the main institutional homes for intellectuals and thinkers over time. I mean, before the advent of the modern, especially the 20th century university system, you know, religion was the place to be if you were a thinker. And so what is at the root of the trouble, you know, in our moment and with our tradition, do you think?
Well, you know, one thing that I want to kind of jump back to that question of why there were no women on the list, because I think that actually may be part of it.
Huh.
We have this idea of priesthood in the church, and it's such a dominant position. We think of ecclesiastical position in such a heavy way that often I think it. My wife, for example, she teaches religion at BYU. She's in the English department, but she teaches a class in the religion department. And she's a medievalist. She studied at Catholic University. She knows her church history. And yet when she gets in that classroom with a bunch of 20-something-year-old young men who've served missions, they suddenly think they know a lot more than this woman with a PhD. And so I think that issue of priesthood calling kind of trumps in some ways in our church the calling of intellectual.
That's interesting. So it's a different form. It's an alternate strand of credentialing that doesn't readily integrate into patriarchy or ecclesiastical hierarchy, not just in Mormonism, but in other places as well, right?
Yeah, no, academics are at least we like to think of ourselves as being fairly democratic people, that doesn't work so well within a theocracy.
Yeah, there's one of my favorite passages in a General Conference talk is from Dallin Oaks talking about the language of prayer. Mm-hmm. And he actually acknowledged, first he says, we use thee, thou, and thine to show respect. And then he acknowledges that, in fact, linguistically, those are familiar forms, mm-hmm. right? And we know that. Mm-hmm. And then he says, but that's not how the prophets have used them. He justifies mm-hmm. our sort of idiosyncratic insistence that these are formal terms of respect based on Joseph Smith's usage and a couple other prophets that he names. I can't remember who. And so there's this sense that, yes, we can be aware of the intellectual traditions and mm-hmm. these other credentials that people outside find meaningful. But really, in the church, what conveys authority is priesthood authority and hierarchical rank, right? And that somehow, because he's a general authority, he gets to be right about grammar, even though, you know, there are people with PhDs in this field who say differently. And he's sort of nakedly asserting that priesthood authority to arbitrate truth.
Go ahead.
My wife gets the same thing in classes when she starts trying to talk about the Middle Ages, and they start quoting Gordon B. Hinckley about the Dark Ages.
Right.
And so I think we do have this tendency to the priesthood office trumps any kind of intellectual argument.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys both reacting to Joanna, those were reactions to her question about in other religions, or scholars have always been in these religious traditions, and it does seem to me that there is a little bit more respect, at least within Catholicism. The Jesuits, you know, may be a minority position, but they're still respected. And Joanna, is that what you're sort of getting at? In our tradition, we haven't done it, and so were you two then responding to her by saying, well, we're a revealed religion. We're a religion of a different type of authority that sort of bleeds into other things. Was that your reaction to Joanna's question?
Well, yeah, actually, that's a nice way of putting it. I think Hugh Nibley talked a lot about this notion of the manic and the sophic. And
mm-hmm. Define those real quick.
The mantic is the prophetic role, the revealed religion, whereas the sophic is the intellectual tradition, kind of a lateral versus a horizontal view of knowledge. And yeah, I think that for Mormons and to a certain extent for any believer, that spiritual knowledge is always going to be is going to come into conflict in some ways with intellectual knowledge.
Well, and the other thing cool. that happens that works into that equation, I think, is that because we don't believe in having a professional clergy and we're kind of proud of not having a professional clergy, I think we extrapolate from that a sort of skepticism of actually knowing what you're talking about when you talk about we start to think,
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You know, competence is suspect, right? Because we're amateurs, darn it.
An amateur
proof text, babe. Proof text.
Very interesting.
But I mean, I like the direction of this, though, because this is all more specific to me, like thinking about, you know, specifically cultural reasons Mormons suspect intellectuals in our midst, other than there's something inherently problematic with intellectuals. I'm just trying to leverage the discussion away from that a little ways, because, you know, intellectuals, in addition to being poorly paid, beat up on ourselves quite a bit. I'm still not convinced there's anything in Scripture that teaches us that intellectual activity or discipline or devotion or pursuit is less worthy than any other form of pursuit. And it's just curious and worthy of critical reflection to me that it has become viewed that way in contemporary Mormonism. So I like what, you know, both Boyd and you, Christine, have said about, well, it's a challenge to patriarchy. It's a challenge to this notion of an anti-hierarchical sort of lay priesthood, you know, an anti-vocationalism. That makes sense to me more than the idea that intellectuals are especially dangerous.
Yeah, no, and just finally, I think you have to remember that Mormonism is, or was at its beginning, an American religion, right? And there's a strong strain of anti-intellectual populism that runs all the way through American history. So it's not just Mormons. It's just that we, you know, by trying to out-American the Americans, sort of tend to take those trends and run with them.
I'm wondering if there's not a movement or a shift, though, in Mormon thinking about intellectuals. Richard Bushman, at his 80th birthday party, a couple of weeks ago, he commented on how we're entering a golden age, I think he called it, of Mormon history. And he talked about how scholarship isn't any longer judged by its partisan conclusions, but by mm-hmm. accuracy and insight. And I've been thinking about that, because in some ways I think there is some evidence for that, and in other ways I'm not so optimistic. I think of even the most apologetic websites, FAIR, for example, they acknowledge a lot of the historical problems now that other people have tried to sweep under the rug for mm-hmm. a long time. So I'm wondering if we are moving in a slightly different direction, where maybe intellectuals won't be perceived quite so negatively, but I mean, even the reception of Rough Stone Rolling, I think, has had an impact on the church. I've heard it quoted in sacrament meeting talks. So,
wow.
I'm just wondering if maybe we're shifting a little bit.
Well, I would hope that we are. I want to go back to your question just right before that, Joanna, of is it more, you know, condemned in the scriptures, or why was this gift, you know, considered more dangerous? And I don't think it is. I'm with you on that. I did a lot of thinking about all the verses that related to intelligence, and of course we've got, you know, the gift of knowledge, and being able to convey that knowledge is one of the legitimate gifts of the Spirit. We've got the glory of God is intelligence. We've got intelligence rising with us in the resurrection. We've got section 88, which tells us to, you know, be instructed more in theory, principle, doctrine, law, learn everything above the earth, below the earth, all that stuff. So we have all these wonderful things, but then the only places that it really does condemn us is on what we've already talked about, which is to be learned is good if, and then it's like you still listen to the counsels of prophets. To be learned is good if you don't get puffed up with pride, etc., over it. So I'm with you, and at least I think the scriptural record backs up. So this is not a gift that is to be at all. It's not a gift in itself that's condemned. It's clearly, I think, only the thing in the scriptures is the pride and the puffed upness that can come.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's go back to the gender question too, if we can, that Boyd raised. I love how he brought in that, you know, maybe one of the suspicions that has been foisted on intellectuals in contemporary Mormon culture is the fact that, you know, especially since Arrington's List, and, you know, Arrington's List is an artifact of an earlier moment, you know, that scholarship has really opened up to women. And a lot of LDS women have found an outlet in both intellectual activity and in professional scholarship. And so to think about the way that that kind of upends familiar gender dynamics in Mormon settings is really powerful. And we haven't talked too much about the reaction of LDS Wave, which is a Mormon women's feminist group. You'll find them online at ldswave.org, that crafted its own list of women who are accomplished intellectuals and posted on its website.
I think some version of that is supposed to appear in the Deseret News sometime this week, too. So that should be interesting.
So is it an actual crafted list? Because I just looked at it as a pretty haphazard list of pretty much any smart woman.
Well, Christine is on the list.
Yeah, she is. That's worth a PhD right there. But Christine, what is your sense of that collection? Is it a list? I mean, are they actually trying to rank it now, and rather than take it from just that scattershot list of women?
I don't know. And I'm skittish about just throwing up a list of, you know, as many smart women as we can think of. Because I think that what a feminist response to Arrington's List ought to want to do is to complicate those categories, to say,
yes,
well, why do we value abstract knowledge more than the sorts of pragmatic knowledge,
yes,
that women have always applied? You know, why is embodied knowledge a bad thing? Why does artistic genius,
right,
not count? You know, what are the ways in which women have been systematically excluded from what we've made into the definition of an intellectual, right? I mean, that,
yes,
that definition is sexist, classist, probably racist. And so a real feminist critique would have to sort of dismantle the category rather than just sort of trying to name a few women who had sort of in some, you know, who might fit in sort of. And honestly, most of the women on that list don't fit into the categories that Arrington set up, you know, that they don't. And pretending that they do is not a useful exercise, I don't think.
You know, that I wanted to bring up, I love what you've said, Christine, and it reminds me of a really classic essay written by an African-American feminist named Alice Walker called In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, and she talked about this. I mean, this is the 70s she was writing, and she was also trying to reconstruct for herself as a Black woman a lineage of literary and intellectual foremothers, and she was like literally digging out the graves of lost great authors like Zora Neale Hurston, who everyone had forgotten.
Right.
And she wrote this essay called In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, which basically said, you know, the geniuses in African-American women's community didn't get the chance to write books. You know, they were busy from can't see to can't see, from sunup to sunup, basically doing, you know, caring for other people's children in addition to their own, doing, you know, heavy labor. The geniuses in the Black women's community you find are the ones who were exceptional quilters, the ones who grew the extravagant flower gardens and who stayed up all night, you know, making the time to do it because they had to express this spark of genius that was inside them. And, you know, Walker's essay has been really important in just an entire reevaluation, you know, in African-American, you know, intellectual tradition of what counts as intellectual activity. And that's something that Christine's comment points us to do, too. I mean, there are women on this list, you know, when they threw this up on Facebook, help us out. You know, I said, well, Esther Peterson, who was, you know, actually a consumer and labor advocate, who isn't conventionally intellectual, but she served in presidential cabinets in the 50s. I mean, she's brilliant, but wouldn't register as a conventional intellectual. Minerva Tykert's not up here and should be. Talk about genius, you know, but a genius that finds expression, you know, in a creative venue rather than a classical scholarly one.
Yeah, well, or even in ways that we think of as more traditionally, you know, scholarly or intellectual, you're going to have to look in different places among Mormon women. So, for instance, primary songs as the locus of women's contributions to theology, right? That's what Mormon women do.
That's what we've got.
But you've got more than that. I mean, if I've been looking at the women's exponent, not that I'm devaluing primary songs, but the women's exponent, which ran for, 40 years, I've been surprised by it's a huge volume of literature by women, and it's very prolific and articulate. Voices are, it's amazingly dynamic too. The voices disagree with each other. There's no correlated dialogue there. It's really interesting.
Emmeline Wells and Eliza R. Snow going at each other is something or Susie Young Gates and Amy Brown Lyman. That's an argument I would like to be a fly on the wall for. Again, I was going to say, I mean, I think there's a serious argument to be made that I Am a Child of God has been far more influential in Mormon theology than Sterling McMurrin ever was. Have to make that argument, right? I mean, you have to say why that is and why that's possible and why, you know, why we need to explode these categories a little bit.
Very good, very good. And I think we are exploding the category through this discussion, and I'm really glad for that. On the other hand, we're also turning ourselves away a little bit from that whole... I guess we've done a pretty good job on why intellectuals are suspect in it. I think what I wanted to do in the podcast for sure, and so we can either head here right now or do that later, is to make sure that those who are sitting out here as listeners who feel the intellectual gift is one of theirs and who are wondering about that ability to stay within the church, how do I manage this gift when there is this suspicion, you know, wrong, right, however, you know, I'm sure we do contribute, those of us who are intellectuals contribute to our own our own stereotyping and some of the negative attitudes ourselves, but how do you all go about surviving in the church? What would be some of the strategies that you have to make sure that you're psychologically healthy and still able to share your gifts with everybody? Anybody want to try that one first?
I will. Can I indulge in a little bit of autobiography?
You must, please.
Okay. So I grew up in a family where it was just assumed that it was perfectly possible to be an intellectual and a Mormon. And in fact, my family's version of Mormonism was you had to be an intellectual to do Mormonism in my family's version of it. And we never lived in Utah, and my dad was the bishop for most of my time growing up. And, you know, so in other ways, I had the privilege of believing that my family's version of Mormonism was approximately correct, and that there was therefore no conflict between, you know, who I was and how one goes about being Mormon. And I really didn't know until I got to college, actually, and sort of scandalized a Sunday school class by saying something about Joseph Smith with his face in the hat translating the Book of Mormon. And there were people just, you know, aghast. And I was like, oh you didn't have family saying anything about that? Because we, you know, I was just... And, you know, and so I never had this sense of betrayal, and, you know, until I was much older and sort of had more resources to deal with it. And so it's been only sort of later in my life that I've had to figure out how this fits. And I guess my sort of underlying psychological makeup is, you know, still tells me what I learned as a child, which is that, of course, you can be an intellectual and be Mormon. There's absolutely no way that you can't. But I do think that there are some sort of practical strategies for navigating in a congregation. I think Armin Moss laid them out pretty nicely in his Sunstone piece about surviving as an intellectual, where he talked about just contributing, just being there, doing stuff, showing up. There's nothing,
showing up for the welfare assignment.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing. Uh-huh. Nobody cares whether, you know, in my head, I'm reciting the George Herbert poem about a man that sweeps a room, you know, while I'm cleaning the bathroom during my week at church. They just care that the bathroom gets cleaned, right? So I can be intellectual all I want to, as long as my body is doing the things that Mormonism tells me it should. To a very large extent, that's true. And the other thing that I think is huge is to speak in terms of personal experience or personal questions, to say, I have this question that I don't understand, instead of, you know, accusing all the time, which is, you know, it's so easy to want to do it. And I went through a mercifully brief phase right after I had my first significant encounter with Utah Mormon culture and the sort of some of the anti-intellectual strains of that, where I was just mad. And so I would, you know, I got asked to substitute in gospel doctrine, and I got up and started with, scholars don't believe that Daniel was a real person. And you know, that's just, you don't need to do that. You can know that,
right?
And keep it to yourself. You know, there's a great deal of knowledge that can be a private pleasure.
That's a great line. I like that.
Yeah.
Cool. I didn't want to cut you off, but anyway, I really like that. That's terrific. Yeah, I'm going to direct traffic here. So before we leave it, Christine, the article that you were talking about by Armin Moss, I think it's Alternate Voices, and sort of it's like the having the calling of being an alternate voice within the church.
Yeah.
And he gives 10 commandments. So I'll make sure to link to it in the write-up for this podcast. But it's terrific. But there was another one that was in his commandment list besides showing up and you know, being faithful in your activity. And that was just rid yourself right now of any expectation that you will rise through the ranks of the church, you know, in terms of callings and whatnot.
Yeah, well, being
and
a
so
woman.
That was,
yeah, we don't worry about that.
Yeah, yeah, okay, I love it. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I had, you know, of course, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, but it was that, but it was one of those things that where if you really do have this sense of a calling, for this, I mean, there was a whole bunch of good stuff about being skillful, picking your moments, not publicly embarrassing people, you know, all sorts of things. He gives you some really great advice. But one of them was, you know, if you really want to be if you want to move up in the ranks to where you'll get these external status type callings, then you're probably going to have a hard time. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to pass it on.
One more thing, which is more theoretical and less practical, is that I think we tend to put too much emphasis on belief and orthodoxy as sort of the defining characteristic of our faith, that faith is about what we think and what we believe. You know, so the narrative of Mormon converts goes, I suddenly had this knowledge, I knew that the Book of Mormon was true, and therefore I had to, you know, offend my family, join this new community, do all this stuff. And it turns out that the narrative of disaffection goes exactly the same way. I found out that Joseph Smith married a 14-year-old, and therefore I had to leave my community of belief and, you know, forge a new path. And both of those are deeply, deeply flawed ways of thinking about what faith is, I think. And I think that learning to value community and practice as much as we value sort of propositional belief would be very helpful to many of us on both sides of the sort of intellectual and or orthodox and unorthodoxly intellectual divide.
Yeah, and Joanna, let me tout you for a second here. You brought up in one of our podcasts so a month or two ago, and it was echoed here at the more recent Mormon Stories conference about the three B's and the proper order that they should be in. And instead of belief first, which Christine is saying does seem to be dominant in many Mormons' minds, it's belonging. So that equals your talk about community, Christine.
Right.
And then it was behavior, when this is where you talked about, I don't remember what your word was, but it's behavior toward each other.
Practice.
It's treating each other how you would. And so it's not necessarily always behave in terms of commandments, but it's how you treat each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then belief was fit third. So it was belong, behave, believe.
And yet, I just want to interject, just because I know, because we are behaving perfectly like intellectuals. We're being very rigorous with ourselves. You know, I was sitting in church years ago with a friend who is a trained musician, a very accomplished musician. And, you know, and in a very jovial spirit, she leaned over and she said, you know, sometimes church is really painful because the music is so bad. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of understand what you're talking about, because a lot of Sundays are very painful as someone who loves language and ideas. They just aren't great. You know, it's kind of like when a foodie goes to McDonald's sometimes. I mean, there's not saying that the
exactly.
church is McDonald's, but let's not underestimate that Sundays can be difficult for people who love ideas and words. Yeah, you know? But
yeah, mine this week was bad.
Yes. And so let's acknowledge that, you know, we go through that discomfort. It's okay to feel that. But that, you know, what happens on Sunday is not your total Mormon universe. It is not the only place to get your Mormon intellectual thing on. It's not the only place to get your intellectual thing on. There are, you know, if you enjoy the life of the mind, you know, there are lots of venues for that. There are even lots of Mormon venues for that now, thanks to podcasts like this one, to which you should subscribe. There's my pitch for the week.
Hey, send money.
Just yeah.
Well,
you don't have to focus go ahead, on that 3-hour block on Sunday morning as the defining moment of your life as someone who loves ideas and language. Subscribe to Dialogue, you know, read
yes.
the New York Times, do all of that, and realize that, you know, church has a function. What we do at church on Sunday has a purpose. And it's almost ritual in terms of demonstrating, you know, willingness to belong and ability to get along and serve. It can feel limiting. It's not going to necessarily nourish you if you're someone who really loves ideas and language. It's an all-volunteer organization that you attend in geographical units. Okay, so take a deep breath.
Right,
go
and
home
if you are
a diet
musician,
Pepsi,
it's just going to hurt.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the other thing that I find is a regular source of conflict for me is that I kind of, you know, there's this idea that intellectuals or liberals or snobby musicians are less faithful because they occasionally dare to voice criticism. And I find myself wanting to say, no, you don't understand. I'm more faithful. This is so hard for me. You have no idea what I'm going through. And once I realized that that was part of my problem, was that I was wanting people to acknowledge the degree of difficulty of my participation, then it was okay. I mean, once I could see that that's what I was doing, I was like, oh, you know, that's dumb. And, you know, I could drop it. I don't need my pain acknowledged, really. You know, it would be nice, but church is hard for everybody for different reasons. You know, if you're hyperactive, sitting still for 3 hours is a nightmare. And I'm sure I don't fully recognize how difficult that is for some people. Or, you know, if you really, really hate music, then singing 3 or 4 hymns in an hour is, you know, is awful. And that's the part I love. So I think just sort of not needing to be valorized for our struggle is also a useful habit of mind to cultivate.
At the same time, I don't think, and totally agree with all that, at the same time, I don't think we should invite or legitimize any more abusive intellectuals. It's casual, it's thoughtless, it's super popular, and it's not right, you know? So
yeah.
I'm all for, like, dignity. If you're participating in a church setting where you're not being treated with dignity and you're not trying to bring anything on yourself, but it's just not fun, you know, God doesn't want us to be angry at church, so give yourself a break.
Yeah.
Very, very good. Boyd, we need to get you in here.
Yeah, Boyd, you got
I'm going to challenge you to absolutely draw on both Hugh Nibley as a successful example. I'd love a little bit more. You kind of hinted at some things, but I'd love a little bit more about how he did it. And then I really would like to hear your dialogue with your students who are coming with those questions.
I've just been wanting to say amen to everything Christine and Joanne have been saying about how to kind of navigate the waters of being an intellectual in the church. But I guess one thing I would add is that probably in addition to the fact that you're going to just deal with a little bit of personal being dissed from time to time, you're also not going to be, the church isn't going to change by a lot of what you do. Levi Peterson had this wonderful analogy. He said that the intellectual is a little bit like a little dog yapping at a big train. It thinks it's making a lot of noise, but it's probably not doing a whole lot. And so I suspect that most of us aren't going to change the direction of the church much. So that's, you know, a certain amount of humility is probably good to keep in mind as well.
Okay, I want to challenge you a little bit. Not that we would change the church much, but I know you can change people one-on-one.
Yeah.
So and to me, that's almost like, to me, the only level that I ever even care about anymore. You know, yeah. If they've encountered me as somebody with an active mind, hopefully they're going to think twice about, you know, repeating those stereotypical sort of things.
Well, and I think, you know what I mean? For me, one of the places I do that is that one-on-one conversation. I've stopped making comments in Sunday school that try to subvert the lesson. I don't think it's going to accomplish much, but I do try to make comments to people one-on-one, and often I find people who just have the same kind of problems I've gone through, and I can talk to them one-on-one about it, and there's a certain amount of empathy that I can have that other people don't have. And so I think we do kind of understand things from a different perspective, that we can use those gifts. We just have to use them in a different way. They're not going to be valued all the time, but I think we can find a certain amount of self-value from using those gifts in more quiet ways.
Okay, cool. Did you want to talk anything about Hugh Nibley? I mean, you mentioned that he kind of got his street cred by doing the apologetics, which allowed him to be more of a social critic. Was there anything more about his walk that can be generalized?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing, like I say, he really did have that tendency to he was very loud about things that he could support, that he liked about the church. He was very vocal about those things, and that did give him a lot of liberty to critique the culture. The other thing that he did that was really interesting is he usually used general authorities' quotes from the scriptures to back up his critiques of church culture, and I think that gave him credibility as well. And I think The other thing is he managed to do this in a kind of way that, of course, a lot of people didn't understand what he was saying, and so there was a certain mystic.
That quality. Always helps. Use jargon.
Well, so one thing that Hugh did that I thought was really interesting, there were certain things he just didn't talk about. I know there were places doctrinally where he differed with church leaders. I'm pretty confident that he believed in Adam God. I couldn't get him to state that even to me, but I'm pretty confident he believed in it. He loved Brigham Young. He defended Brigham Young to the teeth, and yet he never talked about it. And I once asked him, you know, why you've done all this work trying to defend the church, and yet you've never taken on the issue of Adam God. And he just said, well, you know, I don't talk about that issue. And I thought that was an interesting point, because it gave him, I mean, it was a point that he could still hold personally important, but he didn't make a big deal about
the
it.
Private pleasure thing that Christine talked about. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think that does translate into a good strategy sometimes, that, you know, if you have so many positive things within the church, you don't have to share everything you think, you know, and you can have those private conversations if you want to, but you don't have to always share it all.
You know what, Dan? I think I've been wrestling, because I've heard a lot in Christine and in Armin Mauss's guidelines and in, you know, Boyd's description of Hugh Nibley's approach that emphasizes be quiet, tamp it down. You know, what do you do if you're not good at being quiet and you're just a big ideas person, vocal, with a heart of gold. What do you do? Can you be quiet all the time? And then it just struck me, you know, why is there something so bad about being intellectually, I have to be quiet? And then it just struck me. Okay, if you're the rich guy in the ward, we don't in Mormon culture make a show of putting our cash in the basket, right? You're not going to walk into sacrament meeting and roll gold coins down the aisle. But you will use your boat to take the priest and the laurels water skiing. That's the role of the rich guy in the Mormon ward. So Mormon intellectuals, be proud of who you are. Don't be ashamed. There's nothing bad about it. Just find the way to use your boat for the priests and laurels at the water ski outing and do the rest of it in the tithing envelope.
That's awesome. And that actually transitions into the one thing that I wanted to say that hasn't come up yet. Are you guys, is everybody pretty much done with their main points? Because let me just kind of head us home if you don't mind. Everybody good?
I have one point that I could make. I don't know if you want me to make it.
Do it, baby.
Okay. So at BYU once, I was teaching this class on how to write in religious studies. And I was trying to get them to understand that you can write from a more objective point of view. And they just weren't getting it. And so I took two pieces of writing, two passages from two texts. One was about Mark Twain and his religious worldview. It actually came from a dissertation. And then the other piece was obviously a conference talk. And I had them just do a kind of rhetorical analysis of these pieces in the class. And they commented that, the piece, I mean, they caught on right off that the general conference piece was a general conference piece. But the other piece, they started thinking, well, it's probably somebody who's not very religious, but he doesn't really hate religion. And so they came up with this wild characterization of this person as being some intellectual, stuffy person who's not really very committed religiously. And after that, I revealed to them that both pieces were written by Jeffrey Holland. And they suddenly got it. And I think, you know, any way we can maybe help people in our wards recognize that, you know, even somebody like Jeffrey Holland has written in that rhetorical mode of the scholar, and help them realize that it's they didn't go apostate just because they started speaking scholarese. I think that might be helpful.
I agree. That is wonderful. Thank you for adding that. Mm-hmm. All right. The one thought that I had that I didn't hear, I don't think, in the three of you is you kind of offered different strategies and or at least how to have somebody think about their possible role. And so, Joanna, with your idea of what's your boat, what's the boat the intellectual can bring, I'm going to read this piece. I'll post at least a few paragraphs of this wonderful piece by Neil Chandler from a Sunstone magazine quite a few years ago, where he talks about Mormon intellectuals, and he uses the sort of he has this fun thing about it being an attitudinal disorder for most people and all that stuff. But the part that I wanted to talk about that maybe makes a reference to the boat is I'm gonna read a couple paragraphs beforehand just to sort of add the pathos. So he's got the intellectuals in Sunday school class, eyebrows rise and eyeballs roll as you raise your arm of the flesh yet one more time. Fragile investigators and question traumatized new members cringe behind every folding door and every folding chair. But then perhaps late one night, a caller phones with a hardball question to which the teacher, the manuals, prayer, and even Elder McConkie have managed no satisfying answer. And indeed, such callers seem to not want, and what such callers seem to want is not answers, not really, but a respite from inexorable answers. They want breathing room. They need, or they seem to need, distance. And so it's this idea of there is a calling for you. There is your boat that you can bring, Joanna. And I do think it's certainly one that I have had experience, and it's a very satisfying experience to know that I'm the guy in the foyer that they'll come up to, or I'm the guy that they will come over to my house, or they will call at night, and they will simply say, I don't know what to think about what happened there, or I'm troubled with this, and you seem like a guy who's been thinking about these things. And just bringing that attitude of the intellectual, which is somebody who is aware of questions rather than always concentrating on the answers. Do you know what I mean by that?
Ooh, that's
so
nice.
That whole thing is what Neil Chandler is trying to say here. And Joanna, I remember a few podcasts ago you mentioned about just wanting to be able to give your gifts to the community and how hard it was for all those years when you weren't able
to have somebody, you know, just accept my offering. And so when you got to write the, what was it, a roadshow or a play or something like that?
I got to write a stage.
Yeah, you
play.
Got to write that. And it's like, thank you. I get to give my gifts. I think that's a strategy that, at least for me, I would hope to communicate to a young intellectual or somebody to say, you will have opportunities to give your gifts. And I trust that. And certainly there's skillfulness involved. There's that ability to know, to pick your moments. There's the important part. And this is actually one of Armin Moss's things too. It's like, make sure you're really right. You know, make sure you've done your homework. And if you're going to complicate an answer, make sure it's solid stuff that you complicate it with.
Also know there's a big world out there in need of a lot of smart people to problem solve. So if you're not feeling the love at church for your intellectual gifts, just go on Sunday and, you know, let it fly in the world outside.
Awesome.
And in the meantime, learn to play the piano. And you'll always be wanted.
All right. Hey, you guys, this has been amazing. I really have learned a lot. We went down in different lines of thinking and direction that I hadn't anticipated we did. And you guys are all just amazing, bright, articulate, fun, funny, and generous people. So thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Listeners, please know that this will post on June 28th, Tuesday night. Come back and after listening, please participate on the blog discussion that we hope will be generated through this podcast. And as Joanna says, throw a little donation in there, subscription.
Don't miss the subscription button because, you know, it took Dan some money to pay for the fancy degree that led to this conversation. Yeah. We need to help him repay those student loans.
You're too funny. My wife has really become a fan of you because of your pitches. So. But no, we're having a good time, and actually donations and subscriptions have picked up a little bit. But if you're not one of those, join the club.
Yep, $2 a month.
Good night, and we'll talk to you all in a future one. Boyd, we're definitely going to get you back. So this is your first podcast, but it's not going to be your last.
Hooray!
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.